coup attempt. Trump has called Bolsonaro's prosecution a witch hunt. Bolsonaro was placed under house arrest earlier this week.
For more, we go to New Delhi, India. We're joined by Jayati Ghosh, economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, previously an economics professor at Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, where she taught for 35 years. Welcome back to Democracy Now! So you have President Trump imposing 25% tariff on India to go up to 50% because they're buying Russian oil. China's also buying Russian oil. They're not doing the same with China. Talk about what this means for India and why you see Lula in Brazil's response to Trump as a good example of what India should do, defying him.
Well, as you said, there's so many double standards in this particular recent announcement of Trump, because it's not just that other countries like China are buying Russian oil. The European Union is buying Russian oil. The U.S. is buying various Russian exports, including minerals of different kinds, uranium and so on. So, you know, basically, Trump has picked on this particular one to raise at this point. It could be anything tomorrow. Just as he's announced he doesn't like BRICS, and any country that's going to join BRICS is going to suffer for it. So even if we say, okay, we stop buying Russian oil, he could well say, well, you're still in BRICS, so until you leave BRICS, I'm going to actually slap more tariffs on you. Or he could say, I don't like anything you're doing internally in terms of your own justice system or your political system, so I will slap more tariffs on you. This can go on forever, and it's becoming not just ridiculous, but a bit bizarre, I would say.
And you've said, Professor Ghosh, that India has not responded the way it might have and has made too many concessions to the U.S. If you could talk about what those concessions were when Prime Minister Modi and Foreign Minister Jay Shankar were here in the U.S. earlier this year.
Well, you know, we don't have good information on this because this is all hearsay. It depends on, you know, basically what we get to know, because none of this is made available to the Indian public. But obviously what happened was that immediately after the threats, the Great Liberation Day threats of early April, Prime Minister and the External Affairs Minister, Mr. Jaishankar, they actually presented India as willing to make many concessions. And this has been something that President Trump himself actually pointed out, saying that there are all these countries coming and kissing my ass and saying, we'll do anything, sir, we'll do anything. They agreed to a rushed trade deal. I'm very, very glad that that hasn't happened, because it would have been very much against India's interests. They agreed to a range of concessions, which we are unaware of at the moment. We do know there are some red lines that even they have not dared to cross, particularly Indian agriculture. The U.S. has lost a lot of agricultural exports because of the bans on China, and that China itself has imposed in retaliation to the U.S. And soybean farmers in the U.S. are hurting, various farmers are hurting, and they want to push those highly subsidized agricultural products onto India, where agriculture is still livelihood for around half of our population, very, very poor small farmers, and basically would get wiped out by extremely subsidized multinational agribusinesses shoving a lot of their products into the Indian market. So that's an absolute red line for India. There should be many more red lines. I'm hoping that this latest very ridiculous demand will actually put some steel in the spine of the Indian government. It already seems to have reacted, I think, sensibly. We know that the Lula government, the South African government, I mean, everybody is actually, shall we say, rethinking any kind of deal they may strike with the U.S. at the moment. Because it's also evident that even if you strike a deal, it's not safe. You never know what the president of the U.S. is going to decide tomorrow. And whether he will say, you know, that's off, I'm now going to impose some other punishment on you because you've done this.
Wasn't it President Biden that encouraged India to buy Russian oil?
Yes. You know, the Russian oil example is so typical of the double standards of the U.S. When Biden imposed those sanctions, they encouraged India to buy oil from Russia so long as it remained under the $60 cap, precisely because they wanted to keep the global oil price down. So they wanted to harm Russia without destabilizing global oil prices, because it's such a sensitive thing within the U.S. economy. And so they actively encouraged India to import from Russia, and they knew full well that a lot of those imports were then being effectively processed and re-exported back to the European Union. So now for the Trump administration to claim that this is horrifying and shocking and so on, it's really, shall we say, it's not very convincing. And let's face it, we also don't know 3 months from now whether Russia will still be an enemy or will become a friend again. Mr. Trump loved Mr. Putin a few months ago and thought that Russia was the victim in that particular conflict. The whole thing may change in a few months, and he may decide that China is now the bigger enemy and Russia is our friend again. So, you know, we're in this kind of context for any country to hope that a trade deal on often really adverse terms with the US is something that is going to stick and is something that will actually benefit them in the medium term is ridiculous.
Jayanti Ghosh, I want to thank you for being with us, economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, speaking to us from New Delhi, India. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Up next, Israel may soon expand its assault on Gaza to a full military takeover of the area. Stay with us.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could save the world and all simply by collecting up tin cans and empty bottles? We all want to believe it's true, but it don't matter what you do, so long as we continue to burn our way through fossils. Now it should come as no surprise to hear about the oceans rise. Polar caps are melting with every year that the planet warms. Now people have to understand we're going to feel it far.
King Tide and the Sunny Day Flood by Billy Bragg in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Israel's Security Cabinet is meeting this evening to discuss plans to expand Israel's assault on Gaza toward a full military takeover, with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu reportedly pushing for a months-long offensive on Gaza City and central Gaza refugee camps. The Cabinet meeting comes as Israel's siege of Gaza has led to the starvation deaths of four more Palestinians over the last 24 hours, according to health officials. Among them was a two-year-old girl who died of malnutrition in the Al-Mawasi area, which Israel had declared a safe zone, despite repeatedly attacking Palestinians there. Over the past day, unrelenting attacks by Israeli forces reportedly killed at least 98 Palestinians across Gaza, including 51 aid seekers. Among the dead is 41-year-old Suleiman Al-Obeid, a legendary former member of the Palestinian national soccer team who's been described as the Pele of Palestine. He was killed Wednesday while waiting for food near an aid site run by the militarized U.S. and Israel-backed so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF. A new report by Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, describes GHF-run food distribution centers in Gaza as sites of, quote, orchestrated killing and dehumanization that must be shut down. MSF's director Raquel Ayora writes, quote, children shot in the chest while reaching for food, people crushed or suffocated in stampedes, entire crowds gunned down at distribution points. In MSF's nearly 54 years of operations, rarely have we seen such levels of systematic violence against unarmed civilians. Separately, Jordan has accused Israeli authorities of failing to intervene as Israeli settlers attacked a Gaza-bound aid convoy on Wednesday. It was the second such incident in recent days. During one of the attacks, settlers were filmed chanting, "May Palestine's name be wiped out."
For more, we go to Haifa, Israel, to speak with Amjad Iraqi, senior Israel-Palestine analyst at the International Crisis Group. His recent piece for the London Review of Books is headlined Walking Corpses. Amjad, thanks so much for being with us. If you can start off by talking about what is Netanyahu trying to accomplish right now by talking about a full military takeover of the Gaza Strip. You have families of hostages in more than 10 boats in a flotilla that's trying to challenge the siege on Gaza to free the hostages there and talking and condemning Netanyahu's war, not to mention the global pushback with one country after another saying they're going to recognize Palestine as a state. Your response?
Thanks so much, Amy. I mean, what you're seeing right now is essentially what the Israeli government is putting on offer is a new iteration of a failed and destructive policy. So back in May, the army officially launched what we know as is called Operation Gideon's Chariots. And this itself came a few months after Israel decisively shattered the ceasefire that it had with Hamas in the months before. And the kind of portrayal of this operation was that through a more aggressive approach by the Israeli military, that they would be able to A, free the hostages, and B, destroy Hamas in whatever terms that they described. Now, we've come about 3-4 months on, and what we've actually seen is that this operation has failed even on its own terms. The army has not actually freed the hostages of its own accord, aside from a handful, most of them in body bags. And Hamas is still fighting on the ground. It is still negotiating in ceasefire. It has not really been destroyed, even as it's been taking severe hits. So even on the Israeli terms, this operation has not succeeded. But rather than sort of rethinking this approach, the Israeli government is actually seems to think that the problem is that they haven't been aggressive enough. This is even after you've essentially seen the complete rendering of Gaza as unlivable and ungovernable. And now you're seeing this mass starvation spreading to the point that 2 million people are now very slowly sinking into famine. And there is no real reflection by the part of the Israeli government that this war is actually reaching its course. And right now, the politicians, especially by Prime Minister Netanyahu, are insisting that doubling down and going more aggressively, and especially by targeting Gaza City, which is one of the prime areas that the military wants to officially sort of set troops on the ground and try to eradicate Hamas infrastructure and to move hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from that city. This is potentially the next phase if it does get ultimately approved by the cabinet. And this is a very alarming trend for affairs.
Well, Amjad, you say in your London Review of Books piece, Walking Corpses, that far-right politicians, you've just mentioned this, Netanyahu included, hope quite openly that the policy of starvation that's ongoing in Gaza now will encourage, quote, voluntary emigration of Palestinians from the territory. Now, where does the Netanyahu government imagine the Palestinians would go?
As you said, the Israeli politicians have really made it no secret that they envision and want to see the mass displacement of Palestinians as southward as possible, if not completely ejected from the Gaza Strip. Now, in its most sort of conservative estimations or desires, according to this operation, it is to try to empty out those hundreds of thousands in Gaza City and to focus some in the southern half of the Gaza Strip around areas like Deir al-Balah, including al-Mawasi. These are coastal areas. And keep in mind that over the course of the war, and especially over the past few months, most of Gaza's 2 million people have been crunched into those particular enclaves. So almost 80% of the strip is technically under Israeli military control. And so the idea that they want to try now emptying Gaza City entirely, essentially making almost the entire northern half of the strip as empty of Palestinians as possible, whether it's for military purposes, whether it's for more far-right officials demanding the resettlement of Gaza, this is essentially the next phase where that might end up being achieved. And this will not be a straightforward approach, because we've actually been seeing that there are still Palestinian fighters on the ground, including in the north, who are giving the Israeli military a hard time on the ground. There are, of course, the masses themselves, who understand that even if they do go to the south, there is no guarantee that they can get more access to aid, even as the Israeli government insists that they will expand some of the aid distribution centers, which themselves have become really killing fields for people trying to grasp even a bit of food. And so Gazans are really caught in the face of even more and more dangerous policies by the Israeli military. And they've, like I said, they've really made it no secret that it's not just about some military objectives, but that there are larger political strategic goals that they're trying to achieve by recarving Gaza's geography and its demography.
I wanted to also ask you about the West Bank. we're trying to follow news as it happens. You know, the Israeli military has returned the body of Ada Hafalin. But as for what's happening at the funeral now, Israeli forces barring mourners from attending his funeral, the Palestinian activists involved with the Oscar-winning film No Other Land, and talking about with just the expansion of the Israeli settlements. Hagit Ofran, a member of the Israeli group Shalom Achshav, Peace Now, told Al Jazeera, what we're seeing since 1967, and especially in recent years, is that Israel's continuing to build and build settlements in the West Bank in order to annex the West Bank into Israel. In fact, the West Bank is already de facto annexed. Talk about what's happening there as well and how it relates to Israel saying they're going to take over Gaza.
So it's important to keep in mind that the West Bank is really the prime target for these Israeli far-right politicians. They do want to annex the territory, whether in law or in practice. They do want to also empty large parts of the territories of Palestinians. And this is exactly what's actually been happening for decades, but it's certainly in expedited form since October 7th. This is, goes from the government to the army to the settler enterprise on the ground, where they've really taken the Gaza war as an opportunity to go as far as they can to displace more Palestinians, seize more territory, and advance more legislation to formally make large parts of the West Bank under Israeli control. And you've seen the devastating results of this. Military operations in places like Jenin and Nablus and Dhul Qarim in the northern West Bank have completely destroyed and recarved refugee camps and major cities over there. You're seeing settlers themselves also take hand-in-hand with soldiers institute checkpoints all across the West Bank to the point that the West Bank economy is being completely stifled. There's no safety for Palestinians on the ground. There's almost no functioning economy to speak of. And the sense more and more that they're tightening the chokehold around Palestinians is really affecting people on the ground. And here it's really important to note that you also cannot separate Gaza and the West Bank. Not only for the fact that they are both occupied territories and with Palestinian populations, but that the Israeli military, the Israeli government is observing what it is advancing in Gaza, finding very little pushback, and deciding that it could actually pursue and replicate many of the same policies in the West Bank, starting with the north and potentially moving downwards. And so for the Israeli far right, they really feel emboldened that this is really a historic opportunity to clinch as much of that territory as possible, even as they advance their own ambitions in Gaza.
Well, what do you think? I mean, all this is going on as a group of 600 retired Israeli security officials have written an open letter to President Trump to urge Netanyahu, to urge him to pressure Israel to end the war. And the signatories include three former heads of Mossad. There have also been some demonstrations in Israel against the war. And in May, Israel's Channel 12 found in a poll that most Israelis think Netanyahu cares more about staying in power than winning the war. I mean, all of these things together, you'd think may have some impact on what he's planning to do, or indeed what he is doing in Gaza and the West Bank. What do you think the effect of this is? Is there any pressure at all on his administration?
There's certainly been quite a groundswell of Israeli opposition in very Israeli terms. I mean, those who question the war don't necessarily question the kind of justification for it. But what they do feel are the economic consequences of it. What they do feel are soldiers who are either being killed, many being wounded, many coming back with PTSD and other effects of the war of these past 2 years. This is really the longest war that Israel has experienced. And you are seeing both current and former military officials say that there is nowhere further to go. And in particular, the fact that the hostages have only been released through ceasefire negotiations and that they have not been freed by the army, and the fear of what might happen still to those who are still alive, and of course the bodies of those still captured by Hamas, that they feel that there is really not just a breaking of a promise to the hostages and their families, but to the social contract of Israelis, that they are not being prioritized, and that it is instead that the government is instead really pursuing this maximalist ambition in Gaza, that it's more interested, as you said, that to those who see the prime minister really just trying to look out for his own political survival, but also his allies trying to also maximize those ambitions in the occupied territories. So there is this dissent in a certain way, but it has absolutely nothing to do with Palestinian humanity. It has very little to do with even the fact that Gaza is really in the throes of widespread starvation. In fact, in many ways, Israelis are almost indifferent. There are those who are also quite or even cheering on this policy. They think that there's nothing going on there. But it is about what this is actually doing to Israeli society, Israeli politics, and the Israeli economy. Now, what you might end up having is that you'll end up having two thoughts at the same same time, where you are seeing more Israelis say that they're willing to end the war and achieve a ceasefire, but they wouldn't mind if Israel goes back into Gaza as long as they free the hostages, and essentially as long as they don't have to pay a heavy price for the what would essentially be a restructured occupation of Gaza. This is a dissonance that the international community is insisting needs to be pushed back on, but unfortunately this has not really deterred the Israeli government, and especially Prime Minister Netanyahu, from heeding these calls, from seeing this opposition, precisely because there is still interest in continuing the war.
Very quickly, the role of the U.S. I mean, you just had Speaker Johnson go to an Israeli settlement at Ayel in the West Bank, bringing a Republican delegation. You have Trump tariffing countries all over the world, if that's a word, for also political reasons, but not Israel, not to mention continuing to arm Israel.
Indeed, the United States is still the prime mediator between Israel and Hamas in the ceasefire negotiations. And Trump and Witkoff and several other officials have insisted that they do want to see an end to the war and that this might be getting out of hand. Even Trump is signaling that he's seeing the images of a starving population in Gaza. Yet in practice, the United States is almost always defaulting to Israel's side in the negotiations and Israel's side to the war. And it is actually trying to buy time constantly for the Israelis to almost achieve their objectives on their own accord, even as they're seeing that this is not happening. And so rather than being able to actually use its leverage to insist to Netanyahu and the government that enough is enough, they're really not exercising this. Now, this does not mean that everything is only in the hands of the U.S. It's certainly the prime mover, but there are still other blocks of countries, the European Union, which is Israel's biggest trading partner, which is now pushing towards recognition, but is still not activating its full leverage to make the conditions harder for Israel to continue the war. And the same with Arab states and normalization agreements and the refusal to even suspend part of those to show Israel that things have really gone too far, whether it's in Gaza, to Lebanon, Syria, and Iran. And so there are still things that other countries can do to influence Israeli thinking and calculations, as well as the United States, even if Washington will try to push back on it. But there needs to be a recognition that without that collective pushback, that the Israelis and the Americans are going to continue determining and dictating the facts on the ground. And Gaza, first and foremost, is going to be thrown into further famine. And the West Bank may be fully and irrevocably annexed in the coming months or years.
I'm Jed Araki. We want to thank you for being with us, senior Israel-Palestine analyst at the International Crisis Group. We'll link to your piece in the London Review of Books, Walking Corpses. Up next, negotiations are underway in Geneva on a legally binding global plastics treaty. We'll speak with the co-author of the new medical journal Lancet's report, Plastics Are a Grave, Growing, and Underrecognized Danger to Human and Planetary Health. Back in 15 seconds. Lila Downs in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Negotiations are underway in Geneva, Switzerland, on a legally binding global plastics treaty as the crisis of pollution from plastics worldwide has grown more acute. An estimated 8 billion metric tons of plastic waste now pollute the planet. Without changes, plastic production is expected to triple by 2060, much of it driven by single-use plastics. Only 10% of plastic can be recycled. Representatives from 184 countries are participating in the UN negotiations that will conclude next week.
Also this week, the medical journal The Lancet published a countdown on health and plastics, which begins, quote, "Plastics are a grave, growing, and under-recognized danger to human and planetary health." In the study, Dr. Philip Landrigan and an international team of co-authors outlined the latest in what's understood about the dangers of plastics through its entire life cycle. They estimate $1.5 trillion a year in health-related costs are due to plastics. We go right now to Dr. Philip Landrigan, one of the co-authors of the review. He's also a pediatrician and epidemiologist and director of the Global Observatory on Planetary Health at Boston College, joining us from Cape Cod, Massachusetts. Welcome to Democracy Now, Dr. Landrigan. Why don't you summarize the Lancet findings and how serious this global threat is?
Thank you, Amy. So the global plastics threat has been quietly worsening now for three or four decades. Global plastic production has increased 250 times since it began in the 1950s. And as you said a moment ago, it's on track to double by 2040 and triple by 2060. The reason plastic production is growing so rapidly and the reason it's the focus especially is on the production of single-use plastics is that the fossil fuel industry, which produces most plastic, 99% of plastic is made from oil, gas, and coal. The fossil fuel industry is pivoting to plastic manufacture as they see the market for fossil fuels declining. Maybe not as fast as we would like, but nonetheless, they see the long-term trend for the fossil fuel market going down. And so they're putting enormous resources into plastic manufacture. For example, just completed a $6 billion facility outside Pittsburgh to transform fracked gas from Appalachia into plastic. And what our Lancet report showed is that plastic harms human health at every stage of the plastic life cycle, starting with the fracking, then through the manufacture and the fabrication of plastic products, and then finally on when plastic is discharged into the environment. That waste plastic contains thousands of toxic chemicals that cause human exposure and result in disease and disability and premature death.
So Dr. Landrigan, just to clarify that 10% of plastic is recycled at the moment, not that that's what can be recycled. If you could speak specifically about the impact of plastic on children.
Sure. The reason so little plastic is recycled is not that people don't care. It's that plastic is so complex and so toxic, it cannot be recycled. Recycling rates for plastic are way below glass or steel or cardboard or aluminum. Plastics, children, infants in the womb and young children are very vulnerable to plastics because they're going through these incredibly complicated, tightly choreographed processes of early development. And plastic contains thousands of chemicals ranging from phthalates to bisphenols to brominated flame retardants. Those chemicals get out of plastics. They get into pregnant women and then pass through to their children. They get into little kids. And in children, they can cause a whole range of diseases that encompass brain injury, resulting in decreased IQ, injury to the reproductive organs, resulting in decreased fertility when today's child becomes tomorrow's adult, and damage to the liver, which interferes with cholesterol metabolism and increases risk for obesity, for diabetes, for heart disease, and stroke.
Dr. Landrigan, we just have 30 seconds. Plastics and climate change are both born of the fossil fuel industry. Talk about how they're connected.
Well, they both originate from fossil fuels, and the other connection is that plastic production is energy intensive. It liberates 2.4 gigatons of greenhouse gases to the atmosphere every year. That's more CO2 than comes out of Brazil or Russia.
And finally, what you're hoping to come out of the Lancet report in 20 seconds, if you would.
We need two big things out of the negotiations in Geneva. Firstly, a cap on global plastic production because the current trend is not sustainable. And secondly, strict regulation of the more than 16,000 chemicals in plastics, which currently are responsible for most of plastic's known hazards to human health.
I want to thank you for being with us, Dr. Philip Landrigan, director of the Global Observatory on Planetary Health at Boston College. We'll link to your piece in the Lancet Countdown on Health and Plastics. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website's democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia. We are diverse, independent, and yours.
Hey, are you okay? It's okay not to be okay. Kids Help Phone is available 24/7, so you don't have to deal with your feelings alone. You can text with a volunteer crisis responder or call a professional counselor. Visit kidshelpphone.ca for more info.
Listen to Home of Burnaby Rock, CJSF's Lux Rock Electronic Show. 2 hours of relative power each and every Friday, 6 to 8 p.m., and repeats every Thursday, 10 to midnight, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM. Do it.